Hello, everyone, and welcome. This is Bobby Laporte. I am CEO of Bobby Laporte & Associates and host of the Executive Aid Station. In today's competitive and dynamic executive marketplace, we believe that leadership is an endurance event, and we are here to help provide the support you need. I ran my first marathon at the age of 50. I'm currently training for my 7th Ironman triathlon, and I believe that by adopting the mindset of an athlete and by having an active commitment to physical fitness, that today's professionals will have an advantage in both their personal and professional lives. Our show guests are executives who have successfully achieved a balanced life, as well as experts in fitness, health and wellness, and personal leadership. And they share their strategies for living and leading mindfully and for gaining a competitive edge in the workplace. And I'm very pleased today that my special guest is Marilyn Nagel. Marilyn has a really wonderfully interesting and eclectic background that includes over 30 years of experience in the corporate world as a C-suite executive. She's also been a professional therapist and is an executive coach. She uses this combination of skills to develop interactive learning that is transformative, and she also sees insights that others might miss and knows what it means to stand in the shoes of a leader. Marilyn is currently the Chief Learning Officer of SAMI, S-A-M-I, which is a SaaS company with an innovative learning solution that leverages a new gaming approach to educational content. And she's also founder and CEO of Ready, Aim, Aspire, a transformative proprietary coaching method. Marilyn was most recently the CEO of Watermark, an executive women's leadership organization that's based in Silicon Valley, which is where I first was introduced to Marilyn. And prior to that, she was the chief diversity officer at Cisco Systems, following learning and development positions at American Express and AT&T. She continues to be a powerful supporter and advocate to see more women in senior executive roles. So, Marilyn, thank you again for being on our show today. You really do have an unusual background and, I believe, unique insights into the C-level world and its numerous challenges. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to share today with our audience.
Thank you, Bobby.
So let's get started. As I said in the intro, you have a very interesting, I think, and eclectic background. So tell us how your career evolved in such an interesting way, and why did you pursue a career as a professional therapist?
Sure. So it's always interesting to me, you know, when I do some coaching with young people, which is not my specialty, but it happens occasionally, and when a young person isn't sure what they want to do and where they want to go with their career, it's easy for me to relate to them because that was me. So I started in my career mainly in the learning and development field, but I was also training a personal growth course, and I did that for a short while, and I felt as though, well, two things actually happened. One was I was training this personal growth course, and the second was that I had done some work. I had a master's in public administration, and I had been working at a university and in a hospital. I was really focused on the way adults learn and all of those elements. And I felt as though it was inappropriate for people to teach personal growth without a background in psychology, because I thought that we leave people without a way to integrate the learnings, and I thought that was a big gap. The second piece that contributed was I moved and took a position initially as the head of learning and then all of HR, and then ended up running a nonprofit. But the nonprofit was about mental health and substance abuse. And I thought getting a degree in for myself as a therapist would add to my background and understanding of what people were experiencing. And so I've always had an interest in it. And I thought, I guess I'm a perennial student. So I thought it would be helpful there. It would be helpful in my OD work. It would be helpful in my ability to continue the work in learning and development and everything that I do. So there you go.
Very interesting. So in the coaching that you do, so I know you're doing several different things today, but in how you support your clients, so you're working in this CLO role, you're also doing some executive coaching. How do you reflect back on that experience, in particular the experience as a therapist? How do you incorporate that into the work you do, and And how do you see your clients behaving differently and being transformed?
Well, I think what works for me and the approach that I use to coaching is very similar to the approach that I used as a therapist, and that was a short-term approach. And so some of the things that I used in therapy, I'll give you an example. There's something called the miracle question. So and the miracle question is used as a therapeutic tool to say, if you have a problem and you went to sleep tonight, you woke up tomorrow and the problem was gone, what would be different? How would you act differently, et cetera, et cetera? And that's a question that we use therapeutically, but it's also the kind of question that you can use with someone that you're coaching, and I have. And so it's not that I'm becoming my client's therapist in any way, shape, or form, but I can use some of these techniques and things that I understand about what keeps people stuck to help them move forward in their careers. Because I believe that often all we need from coaches or people who help us in a course or what have you, is a way to get unstuck from things that have been holding us back. I think people have tremendous amounts of ability, and there are often little barriers that get in the way. And if you can remove those barriers, then they're off, and metaphorically, to the races, as you would think.
Absolutely.
Off to the triathlon.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. I'd never heard that before, the miracle question, but I would think that would also be helpful even to people who are in managerial roles, right? They don't have the maybe have the coaching background,
and
but just that question of, you know,
yeah.
what would be if you, from one day to the next, what would how would things feel different? How would it look different? And then you can work back from there. So what needs to change to make that happen?
Yeah, and in fact, when I come from that context in many, many ways. So when I work with clients who are looking to move up the corporate ladder, a huge piece to me of that is acting in a way that would make them comfortable with people as their peers. When I talk about networking, it's do you have people in your network of the peer group that you're hoping to be part of? And how you walk into a room when you feel comfortable with a group of people that are your peers is different than how you walk into a room with people who are all executives and you're not, and you feel uncomfortable because you're not at their level. So if you think of that whole notion of the miracle question, of the context of shifting your mindset and reframing how you act based on, well, what if you were at that level? Would you walk into the room differently? Would you speak up in a meeting and share an idea that you have and not be afraid that it would be challenged or, you know, always, I don't have the years of experience? So I think it can work for anyone, really.
I think it's excellent. I'm definitely going to share that with other people because I think it can be very effective. You know, you've been a champion and advocate for women executives, and for us, for me personally, thank you, and for all women for our professional advancement. What have been the biggest challenges you've faced during your career as a woman, the one or two biggest challenges, and how have you overcome them?
I think the biggest learning for me and the big challenge for me was not building a conscious network. And for that reason, I built a whole course around it, if you will, and many people in the Bay Area that know me for that course about building intentional networks. I was part of a startup and quotient around intentionality about your network because of my own experience. So I missed out on a career promotion. I was with American Express. I was the named successor. I didn't get the promotion and was told, even though I was publicly named as the successor to my boss, when my boss left, I didn't get the promotion and I wasn't even going to be considered for it because the peer group did not know me and thought I was aloof and an intellectual snob. And yes, there are worse things than being called an intellectual snob, but the bottom line was I didn't get the promotion that I had been on the track for almost 18 months. And so I had to take a hard look at my own style of working, and I realized that I shied away from networking up and I tended to network across and down. And that was the big lesson for me. That was enormous. The second thing I would say was I didn't necessarily keep up with some of the people who had mentored me in my career and had been strong advocates or sponsors. And I would often find that I lost touch with some folks along the way because I was on to the next role, even if it was within the same corporation mm-hmm. or busy. And so I recognized that I didn't leverage my network. Even if I had people in my network who could help me, I didn't really leverage them. I didn't share what my goals were. I didn't think that I wanted to take up their time, and I just didn't keep up those relationships. Those were the two biggest factors, and when I shifted those is when my career really took off. And it was only because it didn't work. You know, when you have a rude awakening and you don't get something or you fall down or, you know, you fail on a project or something like that, you have a big learning, and that was a big learning for me. So I changed the way I worked, became really focused on contributing to others through my network, and my career took off. So,
and I'm curious, why do you think that, because, I mean, I hear about both of those, about having mentors and sponsors and leveraging those people in your career and also building an intentional network. Why do you think that continues to be such a challenge, in particular for women? It seems like it's more of a challenge for women than for men.
I think there are a few reasons that it's a challenge for women. For me, so when I looked back at that experience, when I had the initial experience at Amex, part of the reason I shied away from that group was that I was young, and mm-hmm. one of the guys in that senior group used to be a little bit too forward. People often, the social networking happens outside of work. So every time we would have an offsite, everyone would go out to dinner, everyone would go drinking after being together all day. And I am not, I can speak in front of 10,000 people, no problem, but I am socially more introverted. So after the day, after being with these people all day long, they all wanted to hang out in the bar and drink and talk and share, mm-hmm. and that's where they build relationships. I, like many, many women, begged off and would go back to my room, call my kids, or, you know, do work. I would say I have work to do, but really I just wanted to be alone, call my kids, refresh. And also I didn't, the conversations deteriorate. The locker room talk, if you will, starts to happen often after a lot of drinking goes on, and it becomes uncomfortable. I was young. I didn't know how to handle it. I know how to handle it better now, but I it still happens. I mean, it doesn't happen to me personally at this stage of life, but it still happens to a lot of young women who I've talked to. And also, often there's concern that if a young woman approaches a senior male executive, and let's face it, most executives are men and a bit older, and if a young woman approaches a senior male executive and says, you know, would you be my mentor or what have you, and they're out having lunch together, people start talking and gossiping. And so there is this extra layer of concern that you have to deal with that men don't have to deal with. You know, men can make deals on the golf course. Men can make deals. Men do make deals in the men's room, you know. And women don't have that same ease because there's the perceived sexual tension, and sometimes there's real sexual tension. So there's the gossip, and then there's the potential mm-hmm. for real tension that adds to the complexity of building relationships with senior executives in the workplace. And I think that's, you know, we don't always talk about it, but women definitely face that issue, and men don't.
So how would you advise young women who are maybe been in their careers 5, 6, 7 years, kind of the emerging leader population, to begin to, number one, build that networking muscle, which we all know is so important, and then to begin to as part of that, building those relational resources they need to be successful, to begin to identify people who could be mentors and sponsors, given some of the challenges that you've just cited?
What I learned to do was to do it during the workday, which, A, I was a single parent for a good section of my career, and so I didn't want to stay late and go out to the dinners and do all those things. But I did shift and make a concerted effort during the workday to build relationships. So have coffee with people, have lunch with people, not be afraid to say to a senior executive, I would greatly appreciate your guidance. I've written my goals for the year. I value your opinion. Would you take a look at them and see if I'm on the right track? Is there anyone you think I should meet or anything you think I should do to achieve my goals? Are the two questions I recommend young people, young women in particular, say, that's the purpose of the meeting. I have written my goals, and here's what I'd like to share them for this purpose. And then the executive says, oh, sure, you should meet, and they start opening doors. You start building your network.
Exactly.
You know,
yes.
One person at a time. The other thing is, if you do these things at work, then you know what? Some people may gossip, but I think you just have to be above board. If you're not doing anything inappropriate, don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And don't be afraid that people are going to think you got it based on relationships. I think women are fearful and concerned that, oh, people will think I got this based on a relationship. If you can do the job, you may get it based on a relationship, but you won't keep it unless you do the job. Men have no compunction about getting a job based on a relationship, and then they demonstrate that they can do the job or they don't. I mean, that happens right up into the administration of a president. You get the job because of who you know, not just because of your pedigree or your resume. And I think we forget that. And women are more concerned about proving it, and we don't have to.
Exactly. Exactly. And we hear a lot about how men get promoted based on potential, right? And women, you know, get promoted based on their achievements. And I think that's where being open to having those kind of conversations and approaching people in the organization who you think might be able to help you. And as you said, sharing your goals and asking for introductions, but basically saying, I know I can do this, right?
Yeah, don't buy into the mythology.
Right.
I think we can't, just because that's been the mythology, I think we have to say, let's change it. Let's change that mythology. There are enough women in the workforce today who have demonstrated competence and excellence, and we have to demonstrate and we have to change the narrative so that it's not women have to prove it over and over again, but that women have the potential, and I have the potential to do this job. Would you support me? Is a fine question to ask. You know, it's also cultural, because you'll find a woman from India won't be hesitant, but a woman from the U.S. will be. I mean, there's lots of other overlays, but I don't want to take us down that path.
But it's all true, and it's really excellent advice. I'm hopeful, I think you are, that things are changing. But I know you see that, and I still see that in the organizations that I work in. So it's really, really excellent advice for young women. So just shifting gears a little bit, so before you were the CEO at Watermark, you were the Chief Diversity Officer at Cisco, and I know that you've been a thought leader for inclusive environments, and you've won several awards for celebrating diversity. Can you share with us how you think the diversity has changed the work environment, and what are some of the challenges that are still ahead to make more inclusive and diverse work environments?
I mean, I wish that I could say we have made incredible progress. I don't think that we have. I'm supporting a company in their diversity work now, and I see the same issues and challenges that I saw when I was the Chief Diversity Officer for Cisco in the global arena. I think that we continue to, there was thinking that we had entered a post-racial era or a post an era where we were no longer dealing with gender issues, and when we still have disparity on pay and we still have not just unconscious but conscious biases. I mean, I think there's always trends. So the new trend, if you will, in the diversity world of work, there are a couple of things. One is this whole idea of unconscious bias, which has been something that I've been talking about for, at least 10 years, but it's just become very, very popular. And companies think that, everyone needs to go through unconscious bias mm-hmm. training. And my caution is, and there have been several articles about this as well, first of all, there's conscious and there's unconscious bias. And unconscious bias is good to understand how the unconscious mind works. And in fact, I've been doing some workshops around this topic, and it's good to know how the brain works, but there's also conscious bias, and I don't think we can ignore that. I don't think we can ignore that sometimes people are very conscious about their bias, and their bias is not just about the things that we think typically of when we talk about diversity, like gender and race, or GLBT, or people with disabilities, mm-hmm. but there are layer upon layer of diversity elements. I first got interested in this from a learning perspective because of the diversity of the way people learn. And that was my first interest in the diversity field, if you will. And we can't forget that, or the way people make decisions, I think, is critical and crucial to be discussed at the corporate level, because there's individual bias and then there's group bias, the way groups act. Mm-hmm. And again, that's one of the things I take from my background in systemic studies or being a therapist, is that group think, which becomes, or what we call cultural norms at a company, and there are cultural biases that happen in companies. So those are, newer trends, but I think we're still dealing with the same issues. Basically, we need to build cultures of respect where everyone is respected and where people are all treated in a way that allows them to, the trite saying of bring your whole self to work, but essentially it's mm-hmm. be yourself, and who you are is valued for the difference, but that means we have to respect all perspectives, including the person who we think is old-fashioned, including the person who we think needs to be more respectful. We have to make room for them and make space to include them. And so that's the new buzz term of intersectionality is out there. There's debates about that. But basically, we're dealing with the same struggles and the same issues because everyone isn't respected. There's an in-group. There's an out-group. They're still the minority and the majority, and we're still trying to level the playing field. And that's the bottom line, a level playing field, because corporations are not meritocracies,
right?
And so how can we ensure that the playing field is as level as possible? It is part of the work that we have to keep doing.
So with all that, are you seeing, you said we've made some progress. Are you optimistic with the companies that you're working with or what you're seeing? I mean, it feels like there's kind of this whole other new kind of layer, like you talked about, this layer of conscious bias, and that there's less valuing the individuals and less respect. And we know that in the broader society, there's a lot of divisiveness, right, and conflict. So do you think this is a phase that the society and businesses were going through?
No, I think it sort of happens in waves, if you will. So there's a whole another wave of feminism, or women power, the Women's March, which wasn't just women, but that whole notion of having such a large voice, women recognizing that they have a greater opportunity mm-hmm. to make change themselves rather than wait for change. I also think the millennial generation are not going to sit by and tolerate some of the actions that were tolerated in the past. And I think with social media, with immediate feedback that there is today, like the situation that with Uber. You know, I mean, the Uber leadership had been criticized, I don't know, 5 years ago, and I was frankly quite disturbed by some of the actions. The CEO had said some awful things and stuff like that. Nothing changed 5 years down the road, except a giant campaign on Facebook after the one engineer posted her story, and women are activists now. So I do think that the climate has changed, and not just women are activists. I think more people are active. And I think that's in response to, we better be. So it's not in response to everything's wonderful and we're enlightened. It's in response to some fear and some reaction to concern about rights being taken away, if you will.
Yes.
But the bottom line is people are getting active, people are getting angry, people are getting vocal. And so I do think companies are saying, we can't afford the bad press, and the United Airlines blow up, the Uber blow up. Those things are going to continue to happen if companies do not pay attention. So I think the timing now is really ripe for seeing some progress on true diversity and inclusion actions on the part of corporations, because they get that they will be the next Uber or the next United Airlines scandal all over the internet if they don't take action, and take action quickly. And I think this, I don't think that's ever going to change now that, you know, based on social media.
Exactly. No, it's a fascinating perspective. And, you know, I think that social media has really become such an enabler of these kind of incidents. You know, as somebody said with that incident on the United flight, everybody's a reporter now. And everybody has a cell phone, everybody can broadcast and share. And so I think that will continue to make a huge difference, because now it just has a whole different level of visibility. And it's unfortunate that that's what it may take to be able to get the attention of executives of some companies. But you know, I do agree with you. I think that could be, you know, one of the game changers. And so I hope that you're right.
It's an economic reality. You know, we used to share the diversity ROI story that said that companies with greater diversity had better ROI, and you could prove the shareholder return and sales went up and blah, blah, blah. Nobody cared. Nobody listened. But you have a case or two or three, like people flocking away from Uber to Lyft, which is the same exact service, but you don't see the same awful behavior. And you see things like that, or people boycotting United Airlines because of the way they treat people. And you're going to see much more action taken, because that is immediate economic impact.
Economic impact?
Yep.
Exactly. That's fascinating. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
So I know that you, as I said in the introduction, you have a lot of things going on in your life right now, which is wonderful. Very busy life, but somehow, to me, you always seem to be able to achieve, you know, that kind of elusive balance that so many of us are in searching of. So tell me your secret. Or, you know, how have you, at this phase in your life, been able to be so busy, but you really seem to be totally enjoying life and contributing in so many ways, and things do seem to be, at least from my perspective, in balance for you. So how do you do that?
Well, thank you. I actually feel that they are. And there's two things. One that I'll share. One is I was on a panel years ago when I was doing, you know, like six panels a week, it seemed, about work-life balance. And, you know, awful. I don't even like the topic. A friend of mine coined this life work, which I think makes much more sense, put life before work.
Right.
But anyway, I was on this work-life balance panel, and someone asked each of us, you know, what are your tips and tricks and blah, blah. And this one woman said, the problem with trying to balance those things is that we love our life typically, and we don't always love our work. And so if you don't love what you do, then there's never, even if you did it only for 40 hours, let's just say, but those are 40 hours you want to be doing something else. There's always that pull and that tug and that feeling of imbalance. If you love what you do, there's much less of that feeling of imbalance. So I really took that to heart, and I've been very lucky to have worked in jobs where I loved what I did. I loved being chief diversity officer. I loved being head of talent and learning. I loved leading Watermark. So I'm fortunate in that. But now I say to people, I have the luxury, I'm pre-tired, so not yet retired, but in that pre-stage. I only take on projects that I feel will add value to whoever I'm working with, the company or the individual, but also will be interesting for me and add some new dimension for me. So my work with Sammy adds something new. I'm learning. I'm having fun. I'm working with incredibly creative people. It's just fantastic. And I only take on projects that I not only enjoy the work, but now I've added a second dimension that I really want to work with those people. So I have that luxury of doing that. I have the choice to only take those projects on. And then I balance that with, you know, spending 3 days in my garden doing gardening or doing whatever else I want to do. You know, hiking is one of my passions. So, you know, making sure that I have enough time to get out and hike or be outside in nature. So that's how I have managed the balance, doing things I love doing, but carving out enough time, making sure that none of them overwhelm or overtake. Mm-hmm. So when a company says, we want you on full time, I say, that's great, I'm flattered, but no, here's what I'm willing to do. And I hold the line. I've gotten better at saying, I can't take that on. That's the second lesson, I think, that I learned from seeing other people who I thought, you know, if I want to be successful, I have to always say yes to everything thrown my way, every project, every opportunity, everything. And that's not true. You don't have to say yes to everything. You don't have to say yes to every opportunity or every project or every growth offering. You can say no. You can say no and still grow your career and still feel fulfilled and still feel good about yourself. So I've started saying no more frequently, and that really would be my second thing, which is in a corporate setting or as an entrepreneur, either one, just say that sounds like a fascinating opportunity, but I just don't have the time to take that on right now. And at work, if you're in a corporate setting, you know, that's a great project, but what can I take off my plate in order to do that? I just can't do it unless I take something off my plate. And that wasn't an easy lesson for me. I had a hard time with that, but I finally learned it.
Right, so. And that is so important for all of us, particularly women. We feel like we have to take on so much, and so that courage to say no, to pass on something,
you
know, it's just really, it's so important. And I love I love the fact that you're pre-tired. I love that state.
Well, you know, and I don't know when. I mean, I think when the timing is right, I will retire. But in the meantime, I'm having too much fun, and I do have that balance in my life now. So, I put in those years where I worked 60 hours, and I know what that's like. And I still sometimes say yes when I then later regret it to a commitment where I have to drive 2 hours. And I'm like, why did I say yes to that? But you know what? It's making a difference for someone, and so I do it, you know. So there you go. So,
but it definitely sounds like you found a formula that works for you. And so I'm happy for you, and it's been really – your perspective on all the corporate issues and as well as some of the things you're doing personally have been very interesting. It's really been a pleasure and really a personal privilege for me to have you on our show today. I've really enjoyed the conversation, and as I said, I appreciate all the valuable insights that you provided for our audience. So thank you so much for your time. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. So that's it for today's show. Please visit our website, bobbylaporte.com, and sign up for our Executive Aid Station updates. I look forward to sharing our next episode of the Executive Aid Station with you soon, so stay tuned. Thank you.